Like Dominique said, I'm so happy to be here with all of you today. This is my first time at APHA, and I'm incredibly excited to share some of my experience with you, but I'm mostly excited to hear about your insights, looking into this project based on your academic background, your work experience, just kind of harvesting the wealth of knowledge that we have in this room. So at any time, if you have any questions or if you have any comments that you would like to share, please feel free to do so at any point. And we also do have shared time for those comments as well, but it's totally up to you for bringing those up at any time. So we would like to start with going over a couple different aspects of sexual and reproductive rights in Latin America post-Beijing. First, we have our disclosure statement that we do not have any disclosures to report, and also our opinions don't represent those of the organizations that we work for and are associated with. And our session roadmap is how we're basically going to go through this session today. We're going to have an introduction to sexual and reproductive rights more broadly, and then a focus on the qualitative research that we conducted in Nicaragua, as well as kind of going through the data according to the past publications that we've made on these data, and kind of going into those in more depth. Finally, we'll move forward as to what's next from this project and expanding our research to Brazil. So I'd like to pass this part over back to Dabney as our resident international human rights expert to talk about sexual and reproductive rights.
So I mentioned at the outset that this session is organized by the International Human Rights Committee. And when we talked about organizing our sessions for this annual meeting, we wanted to acknowledge that this year is the 25th anniversary of the Beijing platform that some of you may be familiar with, and if you're not familiar with it, you're about to become familiar with it. So I wanted to give just a brief primer on sexual and reproductive rights and what that means in the international context. So first of all, a little bit about human rights, and specifically the right to health. So the right to health under international human rights is really shorthand for what is the right to the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. And that is included in Article 12 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. And about two-thirds of countries in the world, about 67% of countries, actually include the right to health in their own national constitutions. And many more than that have actually ratified this human rights treaty. Of course, the U.S. has not ratified this treaty, but we are a signatory to it, which means that we agree in principle. However, we do not agree to be bound under law. So that's our kind of foundational document. The second document that's really important as the basis for human rights is the inclusion of the right to health within what's called CEDAW, which is the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And that is sometimes referred to as the Women's Treaty or the Women's Convention. And Article 12 of this treaty says that on the basis of equality of men and women, access to healthcare services, including those related to family planning, are a right of individuals, both men and women. And I should also mention here that every country in the world, except for four countries, has ratified CEDAW, and those four countries are Sudan, Syria, Iran, and the United States. There are several other documents that are important to mention. The next is the Convention on the Rights of the Child, sometimes referred to as the Children's Treaty or the Children's Convention. And it's Article 24 of this document that ensures that no child is deprived of his or her right to access healthcare services. So you see that International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights is the foundation, and these other documents are focusing on vulnerable populations, including women and children. The Convention on the Rights of the Child, as of October, has been ratified by every country in the world, except for one, the United States. Somalia, which hasn't had a government for about 25 years, ratified it early in October. And then finally, the other part of human rights that I want to mention are a mechanism that exists within the UN system, which is called the Special Rapporteurs. So these are basically independent experts on particular topic areas. And so there is a Special Rapporteur on the right to health, as well as a Special Rapporteur on violence against women. So I mentioned those two bodies, and those two independent experts are able to report to the General Assembly of the UN on human rights related issues. They also undertake individual complaints, they receive individual complaints, and they also do country visits. So they will visit usually two to three countries a year, depending on the schedule of the individual rapporteur. So I've mentioned up here a website, which is the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights.org. It's a UN website and includes really a plethora of resources. So if you're at all interested in understanding rights and wanting to use rights as the basis or logic or moral grounding or legal grounding for any of the public health work that you do, I strongly encourage you to look at this site. There's a drop-down menu that says list of issues, and you can look by health, but there are also many others, including violence and sexual and reproductive rights that you can find more specific information on. Specific to sexual rights, I want to spend just a few moments talking about the international documents that kind of set forth the norms that we usually refer to in thinking about sexual and reproductive rights. So for sexual rights, the first place that we actually hear mention of sexual rights in that way is during the Beijing Declaration, which, as I mentioned, was now 25 years ago. So it was the Fourth World Conference on Women, which is called the Beijing Declaration, defined sexual rights in this way, that the human rights of women include their right to have control over and decide freely and responsibly on matters related to their sexuality, and that sexuality distinct from reproduction. That is a healthy and happy sexual life, independent of the desire to reproduce or not. And that definition has further expanded to include the rights of men. And it's also been central to the recent movements of the LGBTQ plus groups that are interested in sexual health and not necessarily reproductive health. So this document is really a foundation for many women's rights groups who are doing work related to sexual violence and other forms of violence against women and gender-based violence. And then the final document that we'll mention here is a 1994 document, which was commemorated last year, its anniversary, which was the International Conference on Population Development, which is also known as the Cairo Declaration. And here, the Cairo Declaration, and again, remember, this is prior to defining sexual rights, defined reproductive rights, as the recognition of the basic right of all couples and individuals to decide freely and responsibly the number, spacing, and timing of their children, and to have the information and means to do so, and the right to attain the highest attainable standard of sexual and reproductive health. They also include the right of all to make decisions regarding reproduction free of discrimination, coercion, and violence. So there are a couple of different elements here. The first is the element of the right to health itself, and the ability to make decisions about that. The second is the inclusion of access to information to make those decisions. And the third is an element of non-discrimination, that people should be able to make those decisions independent of any form of discrimination. And then the final important element to point out is the inclusion of violence here, which, as you will hear, becomes important in some of the research that Sammy conducted. And just a final note with regards to abortion is that abortion, there's not a claim to access to safe abortion specifically as a right within the Cairo Declaration, but what the Declaration does say is where abortion is legal, it must be accessible, and where it is illegal, women should not die or face morbidity because of the effects of illegal and unsafe abortion. And I think you'll understand when you hear about some of our research why that point is also important. So I will turn it over to Sammy.
Thank you so much. That was a really great overview and refresher of what sexual and reproductive rights are. So now specifically, I'm just gonna go into some of the research that we conducted in Nicaragua. And the first is the location where we went. So I conducted this qualitative study in Ocotal, Nicaragua, which is in the north central region of Nicaragua, right on the Pan-American Highway, very close to the border with Honduras. And the city of Ocotal is relatively isolated and has about 45,000 inhabitants. And it has an interesting history because of its location. It's secluded in the mountains in the north central part of the country. And that is the location of where the Sandinista Revolution was started in the 60s and 70s. So it has this reputation of being kind of a hotbed of revolution, a hotbed of change, and most of that is due to its distance from Managua, the main capital. And so I went to Ocotal on what we call a chicken bus, which is basically like a renovated American school bus, but it's painted bright colors, and they might have like a horn that makes funny sounds. And this is the main mode of transportation for people to travel all over the country. So I flew into Managua, took a 3.5 bus ride up to Ocotal, and was able to meet with Dochita Falcon, who was my community partner and co-investigator in this study. She is a nurse that has been living and working in Ocotal for over 35 years. And she basically, because of her time spent serving the community in Ocotal, she is the linkage between the community and the hospital. So if there is somebody in the community that needs to see a certain doctor at the hospital, which is the oldest public hospital in the country, they call her directly. They don't go to the waiting room where they might be waiting a few days to get an appointment. They call Dochita directly. So when you're with her, her phone is going off constantly for people saying, Dochita, I need to see this kind of doctor or that kind of doctor, or my daughter is sick or my husband is sick. And she is the one that facilitates that connection. So I actually met Dochita through one of our professors at Emory, Dr. Roger Roche, who's an amazing man, and he met Dochita through their common interest in women's rights, basically. And he said he always wanted a student to go to do their international practicum with her. And I very eagerly volunteered based on the information that he was able to tell me. And she and I met via Skype in the first year of my program before I did this project. And we decided together, I said, what are the issues that you see that are most prevalent in your community? And she said unintended pregnancy. And me coming from the background where I wanted to look at an issue from a human rights perspective, I thought that that was a perfect opportunity for us to work together to conduct this project. Especially bringing in the human rights components and the social justice components that we'll talk about a little bit later. So Dochita and I had a very interesting time together trying to design this research project while I was still in Atlanta, and then when I was in country living right next door to her. And she was an absolutely amazing resource, and she was my connection to the community. She gave me kind of the reputation that I needed in order to get women to open up to me, because we were doing this in a qualitative manner where they had to be kind of honest about issues that were very sensitive to them. So Dochita and I had a really wonderful summer together. And we conducted two different types of qualitative data collection methods. The first were focus group discussions with groups of 5 to 6 women that were between the ages of 17 and 27. We wanted to focus on young women's experiences specifically because we thought that their voices may be not heard as much as maybe older women that might have more authority in the community. And the basic inclusion criteria, besides being within this kind of young women age group, which is very vague, was that they had to have been pregnant at least once. We wanted to talk to women that would have experience with the three main topics that I'll discuss next. We figured that their experience being pregnant would give them really the really important context and rich information that we were looking for. Because we wanted to talk about obstacles to receiving sexual and reproductive health care, as well as their perceptions of their sexual and reproductive rights, and then their opinions about the country's total ban on abortion. So in Nicaragua, therapeutic abortion is completely illegal in all circumstances, including incest, danger to the life of the woman, rape, or any sort of situation in which a woman might desire to terminate a pregnancy. She has no legal bounds to do so. And so we wanted to talk about these community perceptions first in the focus group context to understand more about unintended pregnancy. So this is a photo of me and Dochita in one of our pilot focus groups. Because I was the main investigator, and obviously I'm not Nicaraguan, I was an outsider from their community, and I wanted to practice facilitating these focus groups, which were all conducted in Spanish. And I wanted to practice with our focus group discussion guide and really gain these women's insights into the structure and nature of the questions and kind of gain their insights, which were really valuable. So we had a really great time kind of practicing the focus group methodology. And today we're going to talk about kind of all of these obstacles, but the focus are women's perceptions of their sexual and reproductive rights. So now that we've had this kind of whirlwind introduction, this was one of the questions that I had asked in our focus groups, and I would like to ask it here today. What are your sexual and reproductive rights? Any examples?
This should be easy, since I just gave the definition.
Yes. Absolutely, definitely. The right to decide on birth control methods, absolutely. Anything else? Yes. Absolutely, the number and spacing of children, for sure. Anything else? So this, imagine this, but without these two lovely ladies providing examples, this is what I was met with when I asked women in my focus groups this question. Literal crickets. There was like, well, or like, you know, dogs barking or people driving by with loud music. That is what I was met with when I asked this question. And it was really interesting because really women were able to kind of understand this when I gave some examples myself. So when I would say the right to decide the number and spacing of children, women were then able to take that context and give me other examples. So here are some of the ones that they gave. The right to decide when to have sexual relations. That was a really popular one. They said a lot of men just want to have it all the time, but I want to have some input as well. And the right to have access to free sexual and reproductive health care services and education. So free health care services, that shows that they come from a country where medicine, for the most part, is provided free through a socialized program. So they were very interested in the free aspect of health care services and education. The right to choose how many children you want to have, exactly. The right to have access to specialty gynecologic services. This one came completely unprompted by me, and I was like, wow, that seems very specific. And because women had a really strong fear of different of cancers, cervical cancers, as well as HIV and other sexually transmitted infections, and they thought they needed specialty gynecologic care in order to kind of meet those needs, as well as the right to choose what method of family planning to use, as we talked about here, and the right to be treated well by healthcare providers. This one was very important to them as well, because they come from this community, or this community idea of having free reproductive healthcare services in a community health post setting. They had a lot of stories to tell me about being treated poorly by healthcare workers. And because some of the women I was talking to were relatively young, and they might have had their first sexual experiences at a young age, they said how embarrassing to be sitting in, I think I'm going to be talking about this later, I'm getting ahead of myself, but to be sitting in a waiting room at a health post, to be waiting for family planning, whether that's oral contraception or what have you, and having the nurse come out and say, who's here to family plan? In front of an entire room of people that they probably know from their communities. And they said, how embarrassing is that? I don't want to raise my hand in front of all these people that I know. So that was something that we talked about a lot, which we're going to talk about later, I'm sure. So our main findings from this particular part of the focus groups was kind of a continuous circle. So women had a pervasive lack of knowledge about sexual and reproductive rights from a very technical standpoint. They could provide examples when the conversation was kind of prompted and led in that direction. And then leading to that, they did not know how to identify the relevant international human rights documents. So when I asked, where do your sexual and reproductive rights come from? They said, oh, our president gives them to us. And I was like, he probably doesn't. That's probably not really high on Daniel Ortega's like priority list. But that was where they thought that human rights stopped at the national level and did not have any understanding of the international documents that we've talked about this morning. So based on these findings, I'll go back to this page in case. Does anybody have any kind of questions or discussion or thoughts that this information kind of brings up? Yes, ma'am. Absolutely, that's such a great question. So the question was if I asked their educational kind of attainment up until that point, and if that had any influence on their ability to answer the question. At the beginning, in order to kind of gain trust and kind of establish our connection as a group, I did have introductory questions that I asked each person. So the first question was, how old are you? And then each person went around the room and said their age. And then the second one was, do you have work outside of the home? And women said yes or no. And like, who do you live with in your house and things like that? And I did ask, have you gone to high school or have you finished college? Basically educational attainment questions. And we had a mix across the board. So we had women that had maybe stopped in primary school, but then we did have some university students in the groups, and it was a pretty even mix across kind of that spectrum. But because of the nature of qualitative research, it was difficult to attribute one person's opinion or one person's answer back with their educational attainment. Because in the focus groups, I had an audio recording so that all the conversations were recorded. But then when you're listening back to that, to kind of to verbatim transcribe it, then it's really difficult to kind of attribute one person's answer with who they were at the beginning. So that's a really great question, and I think the follow-up to that would be a further quantitative study that is more in a survey format, where you could ask educational attainment, then ask these questions in more of a yes or no, or kind of a survey instrument, and then you'd be able to link those two data. But that's a really great question. Thanks. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the significance of it? Like, if they think that, like, it comes from the national, does it really make a difference if it really comes internationally? Or does
yeah.
it have to do with, like, immigrant rights and the immigrants in the U.S. that they come from, right?
Interesting. That's a really great question. Like, what is the importance? Absolutely. In my perspective, I believed that their ability to kind of identify where these human rights comes from would directly contribute to their agency and their ability to advocate for themselves and to advocate for the issues that they care about. So we did, this conversation did kind of come full circle where they would talk about feminist groups, and the word feminist was very negative in their connotation. And so they were saying, well, these feminist groups are kind of, they're out here to change our lives and make things worse. And it was interesting because I was thinking, well, maybe if there was an understanding of taking human rights and sexual reproductive rights out of just the feminist group kind of mentality, then maybe that would be more of a positive act, kind of a more positive attainable goal, that they could say, oh, there's these international documents that are outside of these feminist groups that are not, you know, that they're using for their own agenda that I can kind of hold on to or hold up as an example. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
I don't know what that was. That's pretty exciting. Anything else? Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, and even their resources, so like having families they can't stay here in the developed country, mm-hmm. that play a role in what they know and don't know, or their willingness to ask the questions to get the information for themselves.
Absolutely. I hope that I can answer your question a little bit later when we talk about barriers to accessing reproductive health services, because a lot of those components did come into women's testimonies when they were saying, my ability to access the care I want is limited by my financial resources, or is limited by my father or my male partner controlling my decisions, and these sorts of things that may limit their ability to kind of understand these issues on a broader level, specifically their lack of access to sexual education, which we'll definitely talk about later. So thank you for the question. Yes. Great question. So those women specifically were students at a local university. And so we did the first focus group with them because we thought that their knowledge of these issues might be a little higher, but then they could maybe provide insight into the women at the community level that might not have that same level of education, what questions they could or could not understand. So we did that group first. Our second focus group, our pilot focus group, was with women from the communities. But your question became more complicated because I wanted to talk to women in health facilities. I thought that that was a really good population to talk to because they would have an intimate knowledge of accessing reproductive health care services directly. But when I arrived in country, because of the kind of sensitive nature of the research, I was banned from all the health facilities in the city. So the government official who's in charge of all the healthcare facilities recognized that I was talking to women about sexual reproductive healthcare issues, and she banned me from all the health facilities. So we were not allowed to recruit from these facilities, or I was not allowed to enter the hospital, enter any of the health posts or anything. So that changed our recruitment strategy right when I arrived in country. And because of that, we had to go to the neighborhood level. Ocotlán is a city of 45,000 people, like I said, and they're divided into neighborhoods. And the neighborhoods each have kind of a community leader, whether that's official or kind of unofficial. And we had to go through, I went through Dochita to reach these community leaders, and then they recruited the women for us because I could not do it myself. So that was an interesting kind of dynamic when I was trying to talk to a specific group of women, and then we had to change it based on circumstances that are outside of my control. So, Thank you.
One more. How about we take both questions and then we'll
move on. Oh, yeah. There's
more.
There's more.
And you guys want to hear
more.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So back to what I was saying, how we had to recruit through the community leaders. I realized that though I would give some sort of requirement through my IRBs that I applied to talk to women between 18 and like 30. But because even though I would say that to the community leaders, they might not have really understood that I could only talk to women that were that age. So when I would arrive to whatever location where we were having the focus group, and I would be talking to women about their ages and stuff, some women that were 17, some women, so it really, that age group just reflects the women that I talked to. That was not part of my
design.
Okay. So I realized that the women, the community leaders didn't fully understand how to implement those inclusion criteria. So it was very fluid. Yes. Really, in the focus groups, because we talked about so many topics, I did not use the focus groups as an opportunity for me to teach, because as a facilitator, I didn't want to create that power imbalance of being the teacher. Because I came in during the beginning of focus groups and I put myself at a very low power level and said, I am not from your community. You are the experts and I am here to ask you your opinions and your perceptions, because I didn't want there to be any sort of like, because I'm an extranjera, I'm a tourist, a foreigner, I didn't want to put the women at a lower level. So I was afraid of doing teaching and kind of messing up that power imbalance. But I think that's why Dochita couldn't be present for the focus group, because she is a teacher. And if the women didn't answer the question, if there were crickets like here, she would have been like, okay, all right, we're going to talk, you know, and that was not the purpose. So that's like the follow-up. That was like one of the things I would have wanted to do if I had been there longer, if I had been multiple people. But we'll just try to move forward. That was a really great question and answer discussion. I loved it. Thank you. We're going to run through some of the specific quotes that were related to barriers to accessing sexual and reproductive health services. So these are all verbatim quotes that the women in my focus groups stated when I asked, what are some things that prevent you from accessing the healthcare that you want or need? The first issue that was very, very pronounced was communication. And the quote is, sometimes he understands me and sometimes he does not, meaning her male partner. Because when I say that I want to work, he does not like those decisions. If I tell him that I want to study because I want to study a profession this year, he says, no, I do not like that decision. Sometimes I do not understand his mentality. So this was a pronounced issue when she was saying, I would like to do these activities, go to work and go to school, and my partner will not allow me to do those things, and being able to communicate those wishes. The second was criticas, which translates to criticism. And women, one of my participants said, you know that when all the people that live in a neighborhood go to the same health center and you also live in that neighborhood, they will know you and they will publicize information about you. So for this reason, I don't want it to be out there that I have HPV. Later, they will say that all the people that live in the neighborhood have the virus. Sometimes it is not the disease that harms you, it is the criticas. So going back to our statement when women would be in the health center and know people in the area and then would be really embarrassed and nervous about the criticism they would receive for being present in that health facility. The other one was andar escondida, which means to go in secret or to walk in secret, and basically translates to engaging in a secret behavior. A participant said, I did not family plan. I sometimes had the urge to family plan, but sometimes I saw many people I knew at the health center, and since I was dating my boyfriend in secret, I was afraid that if they saw me receive a method of family planning, then my mother would find out and get mad at me. In order to avoid these problems with my mother, I did not family plan. And as a result, she became pregnant at 17. So these are the very cultural issues that these women were struggling with when they were young and engaging in behavior that must have been forbidden or seen as negative by their parents or other members of the community. Finally, machismo was an interesting topic that we talked about a lot in our focus groups, and it basically refers to kind of the cultural phenomenon of gender inequality, where men engage in hyper-masculine or hyper-violent behaviors as a way of impacting the lives of women around them. This can come from a partner, an intimate partner, or a parent, or an uncle, or any or somebody that has an intimate relationship with a woman. And one participant said, the partner must respect one's decisions to family plan. Because there are men who are machistas, so men that engage in behaviors aligned with machismo, that do not like it if one family plans and prefers if she is always pregnant, having child after child. One of the women, when she said having child after child, I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, some men will prefer if their partners have multiple babies so that if the partner decides to leave the woman, nobody else will want to be with her because she will have so many children and it'll be so hard to take care of her. So there are these intense issues that women were very honest about and were very able to kind of articulate in our focus groups. So because of all of these findings, we concluded at the end after analysis of all the transcripts that community level programs are necessary in Ocotal, but they must kind of have three parts. The first they must include, in the blue part, is communication strategies within families and communities. So that if that's related to family planning, if that's related to dating relationships, if that's related to sexual activity, then moving over to gender awareness programs, which have been documented in other academic studies in Ocotal, in Nicaragua, but not specifically in Ocotal, the gender awareness programs can allow men to develop more gender equitable masculinities and therefore improve women's kind of ability to negotiate their wants and needs. Then at the bottom, standardized sexual education with human rights components must be offered at some level. Right now, there are no sexual education programs, so that is something that we believe would be very crucial in addressing these barriers that women were talking about. So now, any kind of gut reaction to that? We might be needing to move fast, but yes, go ahead. Great question. There's been analysis of the ability to provide sexual education through the Nicaraguan public schools, and there's two parts of the National Assembly that are kind of going back and forth on this issue, and the one side says it is not the place of the schools to educate children, like in some states in the U.S. that we have sexual education programs in elementary schools, middle schools, high schools. And they said that the school is not the right forum to do that. But the other part of the National Assembly says that if we don't provide this at a standardized level that everybody has access to, then we are kind of perpetuating the problem. So I think it's a dialogue that the country is going to have to decide for itself. In the interim, before kind of if standardized sexual education is to be offered in schools, in the interim, some kind of community organized group would be kind of ideal for that, kind of taking up the lag time between when that would get started. These are obviously like my hopes and dreams. If I had like all the time and all the money and all like the ability to do these things, this is like the gold standard, or what I would think from my experience. Yes.
Did you conduct community mapping to see what sort of organizations? You mentioned there were some feminist groups in Ocotal, and there's just from telling me the history there. There must be some feminist groups there working on these issues.
Yeah. A lot of the feminist groups that the women were aware of were based in Managua or in León or in other major cities, so Ocotal necessarily wasn't kind of the hotbed for that feminist kind of movement. But I worked with Dochita, who knows everybody in the community, everybody knows her, and so from her perspective, she would say, well, there's some organizations that come to provide like emergency medical care, but because of its location, it's not Managua, it's not León, it's not these big cities that have more attention, so there weren't as many opportunities for this type of kind of intervention from an international nonprofit standpoint. And the organization that I technically partnered with to come to go down there would really love to foster those relationships. So by doing that, they built a little casita next door to Dochita's house in order to kind of, so that if people did want to go there to conduct research or engage in community mapping or some sort of activity, that they would have a place to stay at least. So it's very new, any sort of like international kind of research or programming is very new in Ocotal, so there aren't very many resources currently available there. Thanks. Awesome. Well, we can move forward, but you can go backward if you want. And we would now like to kind of move on to one of the findings that was most surprising and intriguing to me were women's perceptions and opinions of violence against women. And I think when I was, this was my first time conducting qualitative research, particularly in another country, in another culture, and though I was relatively fluent in Spanish and had kind of an understanding of my role, violence against women was something I thought would have come up in more of the rape or sexual assault side, but what we found is that violence against women was a much broader issue that the women thought of in a lot of different ways. So this was the most shocking finding for us. But we wouldn't want to just kind of define it, set a baseline for what violence against women is, which is defined as a manifestation of the historically unequal power relations between women and men. So this is obviously very prevalent in Latin America and other regions of the world where gender inequality runs rampant. But in Nicaragua specifically, these data come from the Demographic and Health Survey, which is a national survey about a lot of different topics. But we found that through looking at the DHS, that 50% of women reported having experienced one of the following three types of violence at least once in their life: verbal or psychological, physical or sexual. Then going down from there, 29.3% of women reported experiencing both physical and sexual violence at least once, whereas 10.4% of women reported experiencing all three types of violence at least once. So if we total up those three percentages, we get that 89.7% of Nicaraguan women have experienced some sort of VAW in their lifetime or violence against women. And so this kind of framed my mentality going into it, but I was very interested to see what this statistic, which is at a national level, really looks like at an individual women's perspective. So we also discovered this in country. I was not aware of this when I arrived, but the country passed in 2012 what's called the National Assembly, or the Comprehensive Law Against Violence Against Women. So it's commonly referred to as Law 779, and there were banners about it in the streets, there were murals painted about it in the parks, and the purpose of this law is to eradicate violence against women in all social spheres, both public and private. So once I found out this law had been passed in 2012, I looked it up on the internet, downloaded it, read it, and it is beautiful. It's beautifully written. Like I say, it directly quotes international human rights documents, many of the ones we've talked about today, and it was proposed by a coalition of 14 feminist groups with over 30,000 signatures of support. So when the National Assembly got it, it had already kind of been vetted and been talked about a lot. And what's great about this law is that it defines types of violence against women and provides associated sentence lengths. So for example, it says physical violence and there's different levels. So the first level may be a bruise, and there that is corresponding to a certain amount of time in jail or a certain fine, and then moving up, a laceration or a cut might be a little bit more time, more of a fine, or a broken bone, more time, more of a fine, you get the idea. So the law is written very well and it defines different types of violence, provides very clear directions for law enforcement and the judicial system. So when I asked the women about this law, once I discovered that it existed, women had a really interesting kind of perspective about it. And this is the quote that it still blows my mind. I've said this quote in many presentations, and every time I'm still just like, my brain explodes. But the quote is, "The opinion of the men now is that they prefer to kill the woman instead of hitting her, because although they will go to jail for hitting her, they will also go to jail for killing her. So they say, quote, it is better if I kill her. That is the opinion of the men now, young and old. I say it is awful how lost the men are, because those are their thoughts now, that it is better to kill the woman. This began because of Law 779. The law started it." So, for context, I'm the facilitator of the group, and there's an audio recording, you know, like recorder device in the middle of our circle. We're talking about this. The participants said this, and in perfect English, I'm just like, oh my God, oh no. Oh my God, oh gosh, you know, like totally like out, that's not what a facilitator is supposed to do probably, but I was so shocked by this kind of statement that I just couldn't even stop myself. And because of this kind of how strong this statement is, I was like, well, is that really true? And I'm asking every other focus group after that, I was like, is that, what do you think about this law? And women would always say something similar to this, whether it was this severe as saying that law, or that the law has led to more femicide, which is the purposeful killing of a woman because of her gender, that they said it was due, it caused an increase in violence or an increase in domestic violence or an increase in beatings. There was always this association with increased violence. So we thought that this was incredibly powerful and incredibly interesting from our standpoint, because we were not sure if this was really true at a national level. So then when we got back and we were kind of researching other aspects of this issue, we realized that the UN Women, which is the United Nations agency that focuses on women, has released a model protocol in 2014 that its focus is to end the impunity for femicide cases across Latin America. So a lot of countries in Latin America have started passing laws against violence against women, and because they were realizing that femicide is one of those issues that they were having a hard time prosecuting. So the purpose of the protocol is to improve the investigation and reporting of femicides across the region. So of the 25 countries that have the highest femicide rates in the world, more than half are in the Americas. And so we were thinking, well, obviously that's very much of an issue that the women were aware of, even though they might not have known about these data. It was something that they knew at a community level, at a personal level. But the issue with femicide is that significant underreporting makes the data unreliable. So we were thinking, well, maybe because now femicide has been defined by Law 779, that leads to improved reporting, which may be reliable, may not be, but then can that lead to effective public health programming? So this is kind of the issue that we've been talking about a lot within kind of our research group, and trying to understand like what is really needed to make the law more effective at reducing femicide instead of maybe increasing it. So our main findings from that specific portion is that in the center in the yellow, Law 779 may be ineffective. The women view it as being ineffective. They don't think that it's really protecting them. They think that it's leading to more women being murdered. So from my perspective, there's a lot of these issues. There's poor quality data at a national level, which obviously makes this issue very difficult to understand from a public health standpoint. Also, we have gender inequality and machismo, which is obviously influencing the ability of Law 779 to do its job. Then at the top, women perceive that femicide has become more common since the law's implementation. And my argument is that it doesn't really matter what the real absolute numbers of femicide are in Nicaragua. As long as the women perceive that femicide is increasing, that is the opinion that matters. And if they believe that femicide is increasing, they're less likely to use the law to protect themselves or somebody that they love. If they themselves are in an abusive relationship or somebody that they love are, they think that the law is going to put that woman in more danger. So they are less likely to use the law, and then the law obviously is a vicious cycle. Then the law can't protect them. So my perspective, whether the absolute numbers are increasing or not, we must listen to the women, because they are the women, the people whose lives this law is meant to protect. So that was my reaction to interpreting all of these data. So do we have any reactions for that? Any thoughts? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. I was the only researcher there by myself, and as a blonde female from the Americas, I did not think that they would really tell me the truth if I did have the chance to talk to them, which I think is incredibly valuable. And this project, in my mind, has opened way more avenues for future research than it did kind of close them or solve any problems. This was primarily a fact-finding mission. This was primarily a chance for me to document the lived experiences of the participants. And as such, I felt very powerless to kind of improve their lives in any way. This was me just documenting their experiences. And in the future, I would love to talk to men to understand their side of things. I would love to talk to political leaders and clergy members and all these other influential members of society. But because I was just one person and it was just me, I did not have the time or resources to do so. But that would be great. Hint, hint to any future student that wants to, or anybody that wants to do this.
Funders,
anyone out there. I'll do this. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So I actually got the other side of that, that a lot of men were almost afraid to approach women
Interesting. That would be so, right? Like, that's the value of hearing the other side or the other perspective of this issue, because the women had a very different reaction. So I think that is that is a totally valid thing if that's what's happening. And obviously then the law is not, maybe it's being used too much or used too frivolously, right? So I think people probably have a different perspective, whether they're on the end of kind of being punished by the law or using the law to protect themselves. So it's a very difficult kind of balance. Cool. Awesome. Well, now we can move forward to one of the most difficult parts of this project for me. So we wanted to talk about abortion because it's illegal and because it's so stigmatized and criminalized in this society. And basically, I never told anybody outside of the research team or outside of my participants that we were going to talk about abortion, because I knew that it was so highly controversial that just the theory that I might talk about abortion was why I was banned from all the health facilities. So I knew going into it that this was a very serious issue and a very intense idea just to even talk about it. So to provide some context, the total ban was passed in 2006, and it's a national law that criminalizes therapeutic abortion in all circumstances, like I said. So it doesn't matter how the pregnancy began, the woman is never allowed to want or desire an abortion that is safe. So that's obviously, this decision was strongly supported by the Catholic Church, and there are harsh penalties for both the women who obtain abortions as well as the providers that perform them. So the law is not just against the women, it's both against women and providers. And because of this kind of duality of the law, it's led to what we call the chilling effect, which on healthcare providers, which prevents healthcare providers from wanting to engage in any healthcare interaction where they could even be perceived as being complicit in an abortion. So if a woman, for example, if she is pregnant and starts hemorrhaging for a reason completely unrelated to abortion, if she goes to a health facility because of this law, healthcare providers are more likely to say, I don't want to provide you care. I don't want anybody to say that I somehow was providing you an abortion or ending your pregnancy. So providers were less interested in providing post-abortion care or any sort of emergency obstetric care in Nicaragua because of this law. And even though this is happening, women kind of are aware of this. So even if a woman is hemorrhaging or has some sort of obstetric emergency, she's less likely to seek care because she doesn't want anybody to think she had an unsafe abortion and now is having complications and needed care. So it's a very vicious cycle. And complications from unsafe abortion contribute highly to the country's maternal mortality ratio. So these are issues that we are aware that the total ban could directly lead to higher maternal morbidity and mortality. So we talked to, sorry, the word abortion has an N on the bottom. It's supposed to be all together. But when we talked to women about their opinions about abortion and the total ban, women were neither completely for nor against the total ban. So one of the phrases that women always said when I asked them about abortion was the phrase, El niño no tiene culpa, which means the child is not at fault. And one of the participants said, but the child is not to blame for what the father, the man, did to the woman. In this situation, one has to start thinking that the child is not at fault. She must have it, because either way, the child comes from her belly, her womb, and she has to have it, accept it. So women were very resigned to the fact that once they became pregnant, they just had to go through with it, regardless of what had happened, regardless of how they felt about it. Women had felt this duty to kind of carry the pregnancy to term. Then we also talked about the total ban specifically, and one participant said, but I say you should not abort, because one must fight for her children because our parents fought for us. So I agree with the law, and at the same time, I don't, you know? So there was this interesting, people fell on a spectrum of, most people were neither completely for, completely against, they were somewhere in the middle. Maybe in circumstances related to rape, or in some specific circumstances, maybe a woman could desire an abortion, and that's maybe okay. Everything was couched in maybes and perhapses, but it depends, which is our favorite answer in public health, right? It depends. So this was my experience in talking to women about this this law and this policy specifically. So any thoughts about that? I didn't have a slide for a question. Yes?
Can I ask a question real quick? What was the law prior to that?
Great question. So therapeutic abortion had been legal in most of these extreme circumstances, incest, rape, danger to the life of the woman, etc., since the 1800s. 1800s. And then Daniel Ortega wanted to be president again. And then the Catholic Church was like, hey, we'll make you president if you like pass this law real quick. And so he passed the law, like agreed to pass the law so that he could be elected. So it's just, you know, really, right. It's really positive. Really great. So we all feel really positively about that. Yes.
What is the general consensus in Nicaragua if, because, you know, a lot of reasons why women might want an abortion is, you know, it's very taboo to be pregnant out of wedlock or something like that. Mm-hmm. What is the general?
In Nicaragua, it was pretty uncommon for the women that I talked to be married, like legally married. So they were all acompañada, which is like in a serious committed relationship, but there's no documentation of the union. So women, since it was so stigmatized, women were saying, well, I don't want to go to the health facility to get birth control because people will know and judge me. But then when they became pregnant, it was like kind of a fact of life. It seemed like there was so much judgment and shame on acquiring birth control, but then when people became pregnant, they were like, well, my mom was mad, but the same thing, she got pregnant with me the same way. So it's kind of like this societal kind of history of having this be the norm. And so it was more uncommon and more against the norm for women to want to family plan in any way. And it was like, well, my mom became pregnant this way, or my sister already was pregnant. You know, it's like people, it wasn't as shameful as it might be in the U.S. or in other contexts. That's a great question. So that is actually, you are, look at you. You're just like knowing things about things. It's really great. So I did the focus groups first to understand the community context and the community perspectives on these issues, because as an outsider, I did not know a lot of this coming in. I might have read about it or seen like a news article, but these focus groups were way more helpful to me. So I followed up the focus groups with 10 in-depth interviews, which were done on a one-on-one basis with women aged 16 to 23. Again, that was just who was recruited. That was not because of any kind of target that I had. And then the inclusion criteria, including all of the things, they'd be Spanish speaking, young women, all of these things, they had to have experienced an unintended pregnancy in their lifetime. And a lot of the ways that I found these women was through the focus groups. So if I was in a focus group and then one of the women said, well, you know, my pregnancy was unintended and da da da, then I would remember them, contact them after the focus group and say, hey, would you be comfortable talking to me more about that specific experience? So it's more of a targeted, kind of purpose-driven sampling. And then they would connect me with women that they knew who had had an unintended pregnancy. So then it just kind of snowballed out from there. And the main topics, we talked about a lot of different things. Sometimes their babies were there, so there's a lot of screaming and crying and between all the questions. But we talked about pregnancy history, the medical attention they received during pregnancy and during labor, as well as the circumstances surrounding the pregnancy, how they got pregnant, how their parents reacted, their partner reacted, etc. And then any experience with abortion, either wanting one or having one, or if they ever thought about it, etc. And the picture is of me and one of my during the day when I wasn't doing data collection, I volunteered at a school for children with disabilities and ended up creating this like little curriculum for the older students about like how we like make decisions and how we like talk to our friends and like all this really kind of really like fun public health stuff. And that was one of the teachers that I worked with. And so she was one of the people that I kind of would bounce ideas off of related to the in-depth interview, though I never interviewed her directly, but she was really helpful. So I talked to 10 women total after doing 2 pilots, and the in-depth interview data is really hard to kind of sum up in one quote like it was with the focus groups. So here's just a quick rundown of who the women were that I talked to. All 10 had only been pregnant once at the time of our interview. 6 are single mothers. 6 identified as evangelical Christian. That's one of those questions, intro questions that I asked at the beginning. 5 had gotten pregnant between the ages of 14 and 17. 5 are currently in school, whether that's they're finishing high school or they're in some sort of college level course. 4 mentioned considering an unsafe abortion when they found out they were pregnant. 2 are employed outside the home. So that provides a lot of context for how difficult it is for women in a world to have a baby and then also be able to work outside the home, which creates kind of an economical dependence on their parents or their partners or a combination of the two. And 2 became pregnant from non-consensual sex. So the women that I talked to, neither of them used the word rape, violación, neither of them said that word. It was all non-consensual or I didn't want it. So two revealed that in the interviews. One received an unsafe abortion and zero said they wanted more children right now. Regardless of how old they were or how old their children were, none of them said, I would like to have another baby right now. So I thought that that was a very kind of comprehensive picture of who I talked to. And moving forward, at this point, I would like to tell the story of my participant that had the unsafe abortion. And obviously at this time, it is very sensitive. And there are some triggers that may be kind of upsetting to some of us here. And obviously I'm not gonna be offended if you'd like to go get a drink of water or go walk around or whatever. I just wanna give you the opportunity to kind of decide for yourself whether you'd like to listen. And it'll take about 10 minutes, so you won't miss very much, I promise, if you decide to go out and come back. But I talked to a girl named Anna Maria. I've changed her name to protect her identity. And when she was 19 years old at the time of our interview, but she also was 19 years old when this experience happened to her. And at the time, she had finished 1 year of university, but because it's so expensive, she couldn't afford to continue with her studies. And she was raped by her godfather. Her godfather was her older brother's best friend, and he is married and has kids of his own. And married, I'm not sure if that means legally married, like ring on the finger and like paper and pen, but he is in a committed relationship with children. And she became pregnant from this experience. It was her first sexual encounter, and she was not on any form of birth control, and there was no condom used or anything, and she became pregnant. And he scared her into silence. When she found out she was pregnant, she received one pregnancy test from the pharmacy, like a local, just a urine test. And she was so terrified that she traveled to a local laboratory to get a blood test to confirm it. And for whatever reason, he was the first person that she told. And she said that after telling him, he incessantly called and texted her and said, you are not to tell anyone. Everyone will judge you. Everyone will be mad at you. I don't want to lose my wife and children, like all of these things. And basically was incessantly contacting her and verbally harassing her. And he forced her to get an unsafe abortion, which cost roughly the equivalent of $120 US. And he had found out where a local woman lived to provide these services. He literally got the money, gave it to her, and physically put her on a public bus and sent her to the town where the woman lived. And she became septic from this experience. She said she did not receive any pain medication. She did not receive any shots that she was aware of. And the abortion was performed using the device used for a Papa Nicolau, which is a pap smear. So the woman inserted a speculum into her and then used what Anna Maria called an iron rod. And when I asked, well, what happened? Like, what was it like? She made this hand motion. So this is kind of the context of what was happening and how the abortion was performed. And because of that, she got her uterus was perforated. And so there was a hole in her uterus that was probably caused by the iron rod, and she became septic. She returned home, noticed that the woman said, you might pass a few clots, but you'll be okay. She started passing large fetid clots and then had this really high fever that caused her to hallucinate and not be able to speak. And her mom was so confused. Her mom was like, what is going on with you? What happened? And she was so terrified because she knew what she had done, what she had been forced to do was illegal, that she refused to tell anyone. And she's getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And 3-4 days pass. Finally, her brother comes to her and says, something is wrong. And you need to tell me what it is. I don't care what it is, but you need to tell me. She finally told him the whole story, and he contacted a local nurse that provides post-abortion care, is the only one in the region that will do so, and she was able to receive medical attention from this nurse in secret. And she was in the hospital for 11 days, received multiple surgical procedures and other procedures in order to save her uterus, which she was able to save it, but being on tons of antibiotics and continuing to be on medication at the time of our interview. So now she has dreams of continuing on with her life. At this point, we don't know if she's tried to use Law 779 to bring her attacker to justice. We don't believe that she has any desire to do so because she was so scarred and kind of traumatized by this experience that I was one of the first people she told about it, that said, told the whole story beginning to end. And honestly, I could not do very much for her in that moment. And besides providing her taxi fare and some cookies and juice while we were talking, there was really nothing else that I could do for her. But I promised right then and there, and I've kept that promise, is that I've told this story in 5 or 6 different venues. Over dinner parties, some really fun at parties, but also in professional engagements like this, where I feel like it is important for me to bear witness to her lived experience and share it with others who may have the ability to do more than I could have in that moment. And just to raise our awareness about this issue. So Anna Maria was my first and only woman in in my groups that actually had the unsafe abortion and was able to talk about it with me. So I would like to recognize her and recognize her experience. So finally, from all of this, the final kind of thoughts are that we've realized conservative social norms, so those that are shaming women for receiving family planning and these gender inequality and all of these social norms, plus restrictive laws related to sexual reproductive health, whether that's the total ban on abortion or the lack of comprehensive sexual education in schools, have led to kind of 3 main outcomes. The women said that sexual reproductive health is highly stigmatized, and these socially conservative norms and restrictive laws mitigate the effectiveness of Law 779, which is meant to protect the women and kind of improve their lives. Finally, they reinforce the criminalization of abortion and kind of keep us in this cycle that we have since been unable to break. And so we call for, my slide is weird, but we call for comprehensive sexual education, like we were saying, whether that's at the federal level or through international NGOs, as well as adequate enforcement of Law 779, using the model protocol, giving women the agency to be able to use the law effectively, but not overuse it and putting men at more risk of being unfairly accused, I guess, as well as the decriminalization of abortion. And returning to the 1800s, which, returning to when abortion was not as highly criminalized and puts women in such a major risk. So I think that is all of that. Do we have any thoughts, reactions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. What is that going to mean? You said she spent 11 days in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Was it under a different pretense? The nurse was protecting her.
Great question. So the nurse that provides, that is the only one in, basically the only one in Ocotal to provide this service, hint, it's Chochita. She's not embarrassed about it. She talks about it all the time. But she was contacted by the brother of Ana Maria and her aunt, kind of her whole family, contacted Chochita, and she said, okay, bring her to the hospital at this such and such a time and such a door, and brought Anna Maria into the hospital and was treating her with her, kind of, she had like a little like secret club of OBGYNs and nurses that agree to provide post-abortion care. They do not engage in providing any unsafe abortions, but they will provide post-abortion care, which is included in human rights documents as something that women should have a right to have access to. And then because of that, the leader of all the public health or the public health clinics and stuff, the one that banned me from the health facilities, found out that the woman was receiving treatment there, that Anna Maria was receiving treatment, went to Chochita and said, you must cease treatment and call the police. And Chochita said, no. She said, I am a woman, I am a mother, and I refuse to do that. I'm here to protect the life of this woman. And of course, the director did not like that very much. And thank goodness, the director didn't call the police herself. So when I arrived in country, this had just happened the week before I got there. So I was told by some of our partners that, well, the police might come for Chochita, so if you could just get to Honduras. And I was like, I am not prepared. I'm not prepared for this. So it was very much like an actual serious situation of how this law affects people's safety and people's access to healthcare services. So she received she was in the Ocotal Hospital like 5 days when she was receiving the uterine surgery and a lot of the x-rays. Then they transferred her to another inpatient clinic where she was inpatient there for the rest of the time. So at that point, once Chochita kind of stood up to the director, thank goodness the director didn't call the police and report this issue. So she was able to receive the treatment that she needed. Yeah, of course.
Perfect. So the information that you presented earlier about like how a lot of conditions won't provide criminal
yes.
And then you said like there's a high rate of death with abortion. Where does that data come from?
This is another issue very similar to femicide, in which it's really hard to identify those data. It's really hard to quantify the number of deaths from unsafe abortion because they can look so similar to other obstetric emergencies. And so really the data is very difficult, and in some cases it is unreliable. Though we believe that I can't remember the exact number now, it's like 260 deaths per 100,000 live births is Nicaragua's maternal mortality ratio. And researchers you can only guesstimate. If you give them a survey and say, have you had an unsafe abortion? Who's gonna check that box, yes, you know? And if you've had any complications, have you, yes or no? So I think that is an issue with data quality, that we are not able to really identify exactly how much, how many, like number-wise, like, we don't have an N for how many women have died from complications from unsafe abortion. But researchers are able to hypothetically say 1/3 based on a review of medical records or documenting women's, their verbal autopsies. So verbal autopsies are a method that have been used in other contexts to identify the stories of other women who have died from like non-natural causes, whether that's complications from an unsafe abortion or femicide or some other issue. It's been used to ask a woman, hey, how about your sisters or your friends or any women that you may know, and creating a web of kind of documentation that way.
So it's national data, or is it like specific privately
funded research? I believe it's not going to necessarily be at a national level. The DHS is not going to have a question that asks this, so it's definitely kind of piecemeal based on feminist organizations that may want to count this, and then Guttmacher and other institutes maybe based here or based in the developed world that have an interest in this issue. Good question. Yes. That's a great question. It's interesting because there's a few other countries in the world that have similar total bans. El Salvador is one of them. And El Salvador is one of those countries where women are thrown in jail for decades for this offense. And the law is written very similarly. It has similar sentence lengths for both providers and women. But in Nicaragua, no one has actually had the law used against them in like an official sense. It's more of a scare tactic. So in El Salvador, we can talk about the El Salvador 7 and the women that have been in prison for decades because of maybe they just had an obstetric emergency that was completely unrelated to abortion, but they've been criminalized. But in Nicaragua, there hasn't been that same issue. So the law states, depending on, there's a lot of different factors, but it could be 5 to 10 years in prison. And doctors may lose their medical license. Women are put in these awful prisons where they're not receiving any sort of health care that they might need anyway. So there are very harsh penalties that providers are just afraid enough not to provide post-abortion care because of the threat that they may be targeted using the law. Great question. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So was there a large
Indigenous
population, and did you talk to anybody who was
Spanish-speaker,
sorry, non-native
language? Right.
And do you think there were
any
health disparities
within the population? That's a great question. Specifically in Ocotal, the populations that I was talking to were not Indigenous, but they might have had some Indigenous heritage. That was not one of the intro questions that I could have asked. But outside of Ocotal is more of a rural and agricultural area, and there's like big mountains, and people kind of have like pueblos up in the mountains, which would have been definitely where more of the indigenous populations would have been located. But in the eastern part of Nicaragua, there are autonomous regions that are primarily indigenous, and just because of the location of Ocotal, it's right on the Pan American Highway. It's kind of a hub when you're crossing in and out of Honduras. That was not a population that I targeted. But that definitely, we actually had another member of our thesis team who did a similar project in Guatemala, and she focused on indigenous health disparities, and that was a very major issue. So definitely we could probably draw a parallel, but that was not part of my project. Great question. Yes.
So I want to know, now what?
Girl, now what? You are so on it.
Perfect. Now I'll turn back over to Daddy.
Well, thank you. So I think you all can understand how really powerful this work was. We started out asking about unintended pregnancy, and we ended up finding about barriers to reproductive health care, women's experiences of unintended pregnancy, their experiences of violence, their views on abortion, and of course, this case of Anna Maria, which was really the perfect storm of all of these things. And as we think of, as we thought about kind of analyzing all of these different data and breaking them into different pieces and the ways in which we talked about them, I should mention that we have several publications that you may be interested in reading more. So the first is one that's an open access journal through the Pan American Health Association journal, or the Pan American Journal of Health. Pan American Journal of Public Health. That came out in the July issue, and that publication focuses on the access to reproductive health care. So if you want to get more detail on that piece, it's there. The second is a publication that's called It Is Better If I Kill Her, and that, the first one is called Siempre Me Critiquen, which is about the barriers to reproductive health care. The second one is in a journal called Violence and Gender, and it's called It Is Better If I Kill Her, and that is the issue that focuses on Law 779 and femicide there. And then we currently have The Story of Anna Maria, which is under review, which is called Regardless, You Are Not the First Woman, and there's kind of a semicolon that goes after that and all of those. But those are some of the qualitative quotes that come with that. So in thinking about these issues, and particularly the case of Anna Maria, there are a couple of things that really struck us and are driving the way that we're moving forward from here. So first of all, the unintended consequences of violence against women are the unexpected result. So particularly this law 779, which was designed with really good intentions to protect women, but which had this very unintended secondary consequence of, first of all, potentially actually increasing violence. We don't know because of the data if that's true or not. But secondly, as Sammy said, and more importantly, that women believe that the law is responsible for an increase in violence. And so the importance of those social norms and cultural norms around the law, what its intentions are, and what it's actually doing. And the other thing about Anna Maria that I want to point out is the way that violence came into her life. So one of the things that Sammy didn't mention was that the man who raped her was harassing her in advance of that sexual assault. So he was pursuing her, actively pursuing her. Obviously, he was known to her as a familial acquaintance, but he was really pursuing her. And so there were forms of emotional and psychological violence that were happening there before the sexual violence occurred. And then the third element of that story in terms of violence is really the structural violence, which is that she didn't press charges against him, and why she didn't press charges against him has to do with, you know, the criminalization of the offense that he committed in terms of the rape and the harassment leading up to that. And that also points to the violence against women law again, right? Because if he was harassing her, that should have been something that the structure would have been able to assist with. So we kind of frame her story in the context of violence, both individual, emotional, psychosocial violence, as well as sexual violence, and also structural violence. And so what I want to talk about now is the ways that we plan to move forward. So we're basically taking the work that Sammy did, and you heard her story, working as an individual in this community, and we're taking her experience and these data, and we're scaling it up to a larger project that's going to be based in Brazil. And the reason that we chose Brazil is for a couple of reasons. At this point, we're focusing, moving away a little bit from the unintended pregnancy side of things, and particularly focusing on violence, the experience of violence against women. So we wanted to focus on Brazil because of its so-called cultural violence. And we also know that Brazil passed a law, an anti-femicide law, this year, which is very similar in nature to Law 779 in Nicaragua. So Sammy mentioned that that law was passed in 2012, and the work that she did was in 2014. The Brazilian law was passed in March of this year, and we'll be collecting these data in the summer of 2015. So it'll be just over a year after the law has been passed. We feel it's the right time in terms of what people know about the law. We're also focusing on the Brazilian context because of the existence of machismo and a very gender inequitable society there. And so what we're going to be doing in Brazil is we're going to be working through the public health system
as a main source of health care, which is similar to Nicaragua in many ways, is that it's a universal system and it's a social system. Whoops, sorry, I thought there were more to that. So I'll tell you a little bit about the methods that we're planning to use. The first thing that we're going to do is we're going to do a legal policy analysis. So we're actually going to be systematically looking at the international human rights norms, including the ones that I mentioned at the beginning, some regional norms that exist, and comparing that to the Brazilian national law, both the existing statute on violence against women and the new femicide law. And we'll also be comparing that to some policy documents at the local level in the community we'll be working in, which is in the Sao Paulo area. The second thing that we're going to do is we're going to do qualitative interviews with women. So very similar to what Sammy did, we're going to be doing in-depth interviews with women that are attending public health clinics. We're aiming for about 30 interviews, so we're hoping to reach saturation with women, and we're going to be talking about them, possibly about their individual experience of violence, but that's not the front door that we're coming through. The door that we're going to be coming through is to really get at community norms. So what is it that they believe is violence? And the reason for this is to actually, I think that most people would agree, and even in the Brazilian context would agree, that physical violence is violence. But there are other forms of violence, as have been alluded to, in terms of economic violence, psychological violence, and so on. And so we really want to get at people's attitudes about what they believe violence is. We as researchers can identify particular behaviors, controlling behaviors, abusive behaviors, physical violence as violence, but that's not the way that people in the community think of violence. They may think that it's perfectly acceptable for a partner to hit his spouse if she doesn't have dinner on the table on time or doesn't take care of the kids in a certain way or something like that. So we want to explore those cultural norms with women. And the other part of what we're going to be doing is a quantitative study that's going to be a complement. It's going to be a cross-sectional study of healthcare providers. Because what we're aiming to do is to develop an intervention that will be a health-centered, health post-centered intervention that will be with healthcare providers doing intimate partner violence intervention in the clinical setting. So that's our goal. And I'm happy to answer any questions about our future plans. Yes. They do have a strong family planning program. There are some significant differences between the way that violence, and the thing that I should say, the great thing about the Brazilian public health system is it's universal, it's open access, and it's very geography driven, so it's great for epidemiologists, which means that there are health posts in every community, and we're actually able to use the system to get information out or to disseminate an intervention. The negative side of that is that, particularly on the side of violence, unlike here in the US, where most of us, if you go to your healthcare provider, go for a physical, there's usually a question, which is a universal screening question, which is, do you feel safe in your home? Or something like that. And that's not something that exists in Brazil. In Brazil, the only way that women are treated or even referred for violence is if a woman openly discloses. And one of the things that we know about violence is it's very, very rare for people to actually disclose. If you ask them, they might tell you. But if you don't ask, they're probably not going to tell you. So that's what we're trying to get at. The statistics for Brazil are not quite as bad as Nicaragua in terms of the 89% prevalence of lifetime violence, but it's at least 30%. So for the Nicaragua study, because Sammy was working pretty much as an independent investigator, we did go through IRB at Emory University. But because she wasn't working with an academic institution in Nicaragua or even a community-based organization, there was not a local organization, so we were able to select the option, which was to use the Emory IRB as the proxy for the local IRB because one didn't exist. For the purposes of the Brazil study, we will need to go through three levels of IRB review. We'll go through the Emory University IRB. We will also go through, we have a university partner, that's the Faculdade de Medicina de, anyways, FMABC, shorthand. And we'll go through the university IRB, and then we also have to go through a city level IRB. So it's actually any research that's conducted within the city. So we will be passing through very rigorous questions. The abortion question in Brazil, Brazil is slightly more lenient than Nicaragua. There's not a total ban on abortion. There are some allowances, including the case of rape, that is an allowance for legal abortion in Brazil. And actually, some of our partners are direct abortion care providers. So we're talking about that issue. We don't believe it's going to be a problem to ask about the question. Yes. Yes.
And so did you look at their ability to understand the law, or who was educating, or who you look at that?
So we didn't look at their kind of legal education within the Nicaraguan context, but I think that you're exactly right, which is, there are a couple of questions about the femicide data, which is, number one, is violence actually increasing? And we don't know. We don't know, is there better reporting now? Is there better counting now? Or are there actually more cases now? So we don't know that. And we should mention that most of the femicide data are collected by advocacy groups. And so the data may not necessarily be as rigorous as we would like them to be. And so we have to just kind of qualify that. In terms of how we plan to move forward with the ways that people understand the law, one of the things that we're looking at, there's a really wonderful piece that's called Violence Against Women, What the Evidence Says or What Works Best. It's a piece by Mary Ellsberg, and it's a systematic review of reviews. And so couple of reasons that are other impetus for this work is that, first of all, most of the data related to violence come from developed countries, mainly North America, Canada, and the US. There's very little data available from low and middle income countries. So first of all, we hope to just put a little drop in the bucket in terms of what we know about what's going on in low and middle income countries. But there are several, in that systematic review, they look at different interventions in different countries, and they categorize them into four different categories, which are conflicting, meaning that the data are not clear whether something is effective or not, ineffective, something that definitely doesn't work, that we know doesn't work, promising, and insufficient data. So one of the insufficient data interventions is the use of edutainment, which is kind of like the use of telenovelas, which are huge in Brazil. So one of the things that we're looking toward, although we want to collect these baseline data first, because we don't want to design an intervention without actually understanding what the norms are, but one of the potential interventions that we're considering as we look would be the development of something along an edutainment or a mass communication effort to see how we could educate about the law. And that means not just community people, it also means police officers, lawyers, judges, because the law can be great on paper, but if women think it's bad, that's one thing. If police officers don't take it seriously, if women report, that's another thing. If it's not being prosecuted, that's another thing. And if it's not being enforced, that's another thing. So there are a lot of kind of pieces in the puzzle, and we have some ideas about how to address those different pieces. I want to thank you all for coming to this session. For anyone that came in late, we did have a couple of pieces running around, pieces of paper. Thank you, they're there in the back. So that is the sign up for our International Human Rights Forum listserv. This session today was sponsored by the International Human Rights Forum. Anyone is welcome to join the group. And we really thank you for coming today, and thank you for your interest.
Yay! Oh.